2FM.
Thanks to the two Johnnies for their entertainment all afternoon. It's Monday the 20th of March and this is Game On. Coming up today, our Grand Slam winner Stephen Ferris will give us his take on Ireland's Grand Slam success.
He said the ball was knocked on, but the referee has blown the full-time whistle. We have time for no more. Welcome to the home of the Grand Slam champions. It was in doubt for a long period of time, but in a second half of a riveting game, it's Ireland who deserve to win this one.
We'll hear from Katie Taylor in Dublin today as she's ready to bring boxing home. In Gaelic football, we've Peter Canavan and Neil Ewing on Allianz League knowns and unknowns. And in association football, we'll be chatting Evan Ferguson's well-timed form and that Antonio Conte rant. If you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet us at Game On 2FM.
Game On 2FM.
For those of you who don't regularly listen to Shane Dawson, association football does mean the Premier League and FA Cup this weekend, just to clear it up for our listeners there who are on the way home.
And
thinking,
a bit of League of Ireland
exactly
football.
Exactly, are we going to be listening to?
And a bit of League of Ireland football. Right?
And a bit of League of Ireland. How was your weekend, Shane?
My weekend was association football filled, Ruby. Down in Cork for a League of Ireland match on Friday. There was a League of Ireland women's match on Saturday. A bit of Gaelic football as well. And I even managed to fit the rugby in, which I suspect might be your weekend highlight.
It definitely was, yeah. Both Saturday afternoons and Sunday afternoons games, I must say. Enjoyed the 20s match last night as well from Musgrave Park. Very entertaining stuff. Back-to-back Grand Slam for the 20s. Always bodes well for the future, Shane, when young lads are playing well. So great to see them winning as well, I did believe.
Absolutely. Let us just dive straight into rugby then, because Stephen Ferris is dialing into chat to us. But before we talk to Stephen Ferris, Ruby, let us remind ourselves of those Irish tries in Saturday's game.
He charges forward with this one. Dan Sheehan slalom's through. Dan Sheehan with the try for Ireland. They won the ball inside the 22-metre line from the line-out throw, and the ball was popped clear and Ireland racing through the cover. 7 minutes remaining in the opening half of the game and Ireland grabbed that match by the scruff of the neck. Puts him under pressure. The referee playing advantage for Ireland. Swept back and field to Jack Conan. Under pressure from Lewis Ludlam in switch direction into Bundy. Bundy has it. Gives it to Robbie Henshaw. Robbie Henshaw with the try. 61 minutes gone. It's Ireland with the second try of the game. They haven't had too much joy in the second half, but it was the old Connacht 1-2 with Bundyaki and Robbie Henshaw involved there. And it's Ireland now with a bit of daylight between the teams as they get another try. Charging forward with that one. Running away to Mike Hansen. Moves it out against Jack Conan. Pops it out. Dan Sheehan. Oh, Dan Sheehan with the try on the near side of the pitch. And Dan Sheehan taking the pass. Oh, really on a sixpence. And he has got his second try of the game in Ireland's third. And that surely must be it as Ireland gets their third try of the game. With the ball under his arm, looks to run away with that one there. Rob Herring goes control with that one, and Rob Herring touches it down. It's a try for Ireland. He kept it himself. Murray was riding shotgun. Murray wasn't needed. Rob Herring had it as he broke through the England cover, and that surely has to be, it definitely is, a Grand Slam for Ireland.
Yeah, Rob Herring with the icing on the cake there, and Stephen Ferris joins us on the line. Stephen, I assume, or I hope, you're in the Aviva at the weekend, and it looked like the place to be.
Yeah, it certainly was. Ruby had a bit of work on before the game. I was in, obviously, covering the Scotland versus Italy game in studio with RTE, and down to the stadium, and just enjoyed the match. I was with a group of friends and had a few pints and really, you know, just lapped up every single second of the atmosphere. Shane Byrne was sitting in front of me. We were chatting the whole way throughout the game. And to be honest with you, we both had a tear in our eye at the final whistle. It was just one of those occasions that it was paramount that I was there, and I enjoyed it and savoured it. And granted, Ireland probably didn't play their best rugby. I know a lot of the players maybe touched on that in interviews and everything else, but in such a high pressure situation with so much on the line and so many fans there, you know, wishing them on, it just was, you know, was a day that I'll go down and long live in my memory anyway, that's for sure.
Stephen, I was in Cardiff in 2009 when the full-time whistle went, and I can remember it as clear as day. Did you think, sitting in the stand, that you could have such emotion watching a team win like you did the weekend?
I probably, if you had asked me that 5 years ago, I would have said absolutely not. But over the last couple of years, just working so many of the games, I think, Ruby, as well, like, I only sort of know maybe three or four of the lads sort of personally now, and you know, I'm just like a fanboy with all these young guys coming through, and I think everybody is just rallying behind them with the success that they've had, and you know, even some of the low points that they've had in the last Rugby World Cup. But yeah, I suppose when the match kicked off, I knew straight away that there was an emotion, not just with me, but all the other fans in the stadium, and it was brilliant to be able to cherish those moments, and you know, together as a nation and all the fans there. And you know, I was actually sat amongst a number of English supporters who were amazing on the day as well, and you know, were shaking hands with all the Irish fans and saying congratulations, you thoroughly deserve to do the best team in the tournament, the most consistent team in the tournament. And you know, hanging around for 45 minutes an hour in your seat after the final whistle is unheard of, but it was you know, tremendous to do so.
How do you feel, Stephen, that the players will harness the emotions, and have you been chatting to any of the lads that you know, and what have they been saying to you, if so?
Oh, look, I dropped the likes of, you know, Sexto a text, and Pauly O'Connell a text, you know, obviously big part of the success as well. A couple of the lads on social media dropped them a message, and you know, I think I just, you know, say to them, like, you know, we're all behind you. Just keep on with the success that you're having, and you know, huge congratulations. And you know, a lot of these lads won't have to ever buy a pint ever again, because you know, when you achieve success like that, and you know, a Grand Slam, you know, so many people will remember that occasion. And yeah, no, like, I'm sure I'll bump into a lot more of them over the next couple of months. Obviously, RTE's covering the big clash on the 1st of April with Leinster taking on Ulster in the European Cup, so I'll maybe bump into a few of the boys there. But the likes of Jack Conan, you know, bit of back and forth on social media, just, you know, when he has a really good game, you know, I like to congratulate people when, you know, especially when they've maybe been under pressure over the last couple of years, and, you know, somebody like him was one of the game changers in that second half against England, especially that offload for the second Dan Sheehan try. And he was immense last week as well, when he had to come on early in the Scotland game. So, yeah, you know, these boys, it probably hasn't sunk in for a lot of them, but it will do definitely over the next couple of weeks. And you know, fair play to them all.
Stephen, you're only recently a fan, considering you were a player for so long. But as you watched that game on Saturday, and even at 10-9, I, as a fan, never felt Ireland were going to lose. You watch them in other games, against the All Blacks, against Australia, England in the past, French in the past, you're thinking, we've got to get away from them. But even though they weren't playing, you just always felt like they were going to win. Did you share that emotion, or was I just dreaming it?
No, I totally shared that. I think it's because Ireland weren't playing that well, Ruby. I think there was going to be a time in the game that they were going to, you know, through a number of phases, and you know, the couple of passes that maybe didn't go to hand were going to go to hand. They were going to have a couple of trick plays like the Dan Sheehan. Well, it wasn't really a trick play. It was just, you know, well thought out by Josh van der Fleer, and you know, probably worked a little bit on that during the week. But even still, it just felt like there was going to be moments in the game that were going to come for Ireland, and they did. And I was speaking to a good friend of mine today, and he said, you know, it felt like, do you know when you play table tennis against somebody who's really good, and the only way that you can get the ball back to them is being like really defensive and just like nudging it back, or like, you know, prodding it forward? It felt like that's the way England were. You know, England didn't turn up to go out and win. They were just sort of holding on and holding on and holding on and just hoping that Ireland would have like one of the worst days ever and something would happen for them, and you know, they'd maybe win the game 12-10. Do you know that? That's the way it sort of felt. And I totally agree with you. It never felt to me at any stage that Ireland were going to lose that match. And you know, when they got their noses in front, they kept on trucking.
Do you think that translated to the players? And I asked that in terms of Andy Farrell, I think, mentioned after about the mental resolve. Is there a new mental resolve in this? Because, yes, it wasn't a perfect performance, 18 handling errors, but that didn't matter. It was a grand slam, a fourth ever grand slam, and that's what it was all about, just getting over the line. So do you feel that there is a new mental resolve that the players now will have to deal with having a massive target on their back?
Yeah, well, I think they've had a massive target on their back for the last couple of years, and they're dealing with that really well. You know, we always used to want the underdog tag for some strange reason, and I think a lot of us, there's born winners in this side, and a lot of those guys have come out of the Leinster system. There's, you know, predominantly Leinster players as well, but when you bring that successful kind of mindset, that culture, you know, everything that comes around that, and then when you jump into an Ireland camp with you know, a number of other players coming in from the other provinces, adding to that value as well, you know, it's a pretty dangerous combination to have. And you know, they all, you know, I think a lot of the provinces are playing a very similar type of rugby to Ireland. Even Munster this last year have been, you know, exceptional to watch in a few of their games, and yeah, it's contributing to a lot of success for the national side. And I think as an Irish fan, we're all still waiting for teams to figure us out, aren't we? We're like, geez, you know, this can't keep happening. Like, you know, we're breaking teams down, we're making busts, we're making line breaks, we're coming up with these trick plays, even that, you know, the ball back inside by Finlay Beelam against France for the Hugo Keenan try. Like, you know, that was a Joe Smith move from 7 years ago. Why are people, you know, forgetting about this? It just feels like, surely there's going to be a time when teams figure it out, but I can't see when it's going to happen. And hopefully it doesn't happen during a Rugby World Cup, and we can, you know, keep a lot of these players fit and healthy, and give ourselves a really good chance at winning it. And why should we not go on and win it? We've just proven, like England did in 2003. You know, they won a Grand Slam and they won a World Cup, and you know, that's something that I'm sure all the boys will have talked about since winning the Grand Slam. That the next objective is to make sure and not let themselves down and achieve greatness in September.
Obviously, the trophy was handed out on Saturday in the Aviva, but the Grand Slam is not won on the final day. You have to win all the games. When you look at the amount of players Andy Farrell has used and the depth in his squad, do you believe that squad is big enough and strong enough to achieve the glory you've just spoken about?
I do. I honestly do. Jimmy Heaslip, Gerry Flannery, and I were asked before the game at the weekend, you know, would you say that this could be Ireland's greatest ever side ever in their history? And we all sort of like said, oh, we're not sure, you know, possibly, yes, no, whatever. But that was before the game. But after the game, I think it is. I think it really is. What they've achieved in the last couple of years, beating the World Cup winners in November, last November in South Africa, going away to New Zealand and winning the series. You know, what they done last year as well. I know the French game away from home. No, there's no Johnny Sexton playing, and you know, they still ran them fairly close. So for me, if they can continue on, I certainly feel now that they are the best Irish side that's ever played. Somebody like Johnny Sexton, in my opinion, is probably the best Irish player to ever played as well. And I was very fortunate to obviously play with him and make all his tackles on the under-19s and under-21s. So, you know, it's a proud moment to be an Irish fan. And, you know, I think we all just want this World Cup to come sooner rather than later.
It's funny you mentioned Johnny. I spent many years in the next session after him in Santry using the same physio and Enda King and watching him coming back from concussion and injury. To have his body the way he has it now at 37 years of age, to have the longevity that he's had, I think it's remarkable. And I can see why you're saying he's the greatest ever player, because I think we underappreciate just the longevity, Stephen, that this man has gotten out of his body.
Yeah. It is, and it's the mental resilience. You know, you have a good bit of that yourself, Ruby, and having to come back with setbacks. I've seen you sitting in the Shelburne Hotel with a cage around your leg and having to come back and jump on the saddle, and that's what Johnny Sexton's had to do as well, is get back on the horse many, many times over his career. And, you know, even he walked off the pitch at the weekend limping off. Like, you know, he picked up another bang the closing stages of the match, and this is going to keep happening to him until he eventually hangs up the boots. It's truly remarkable what the guy has achieved in the game. And the only thing left to, you know, for him to really be one of the best players to ever played globally is to win a Rugby World Cup. And, you know, they've put themselves in a really good position to try and achieve that success.
An absolute warrior that Johnny Sexton is, and I saw a few comments on social media as well. The likes of Keith Earls was involved in the celebrations, second all-time Irish try scorer, Keane Healy, 123 three caps, a great servant to Irish rugby as well. And yes, it's Johnny Sexton's last Six Nations game, but the likes of these lads as well, that it's probably going to be their last Six Nations game as well. To have that leadership group there on and off the pitch must be just so helpful for Andy Farrell as well, for and the wider management team.
Yeah, it's brilliant that Andy Farrell had them all there. I think the kids on the pitch, the families, Jamie enlightened me again before the match that the wives and partners and kids and all had been brought in during the week to go to the captain's run and really feel a part of this special week that they were building towards, you know, obviously trying to win the Grand Slam and win the Six Nations. And I think there's the whole, it just feels like it's a big family. And people have said, like, you know, Andy Farrell has a really good relationship with the media. He's a really good relationship, obviously, with his own players, with his own management. But it feels like he's got this aura or feeling that he's got, like, the fans as well, like, really admire the way he's coming across. And there's not too many Irish coaches previously that we can say that about. So, you know, even Joe Smith, with all his success and all he did for Irish rugby, it still felt like there was a bit of a disconnect between him and the fans, where, you know, with Andy Farrell, there seems to be a connection there. And even though he's an Englishman, that is truly remarkable. So, yeah, it's brilliant to have all those lads there, the boys that have, you know, been around the block a time or two, and obviously helped Ireland over the last number of years get to the position that they're in. So, you know, a big shout out to the likes of Erzy and the likes of, you know, Keane Healy. We obviously, I was very fortunate to take the pitch with also.
You spoke about Andy Farrell there. Is that just his ordinariness or normalness? He just seems like a fella you could meet in Tesco.
I'd say he'd be an M&S now, like,
possibly, but he just, there's no airs or graces. He just seems
so relatable.
Yeah,
he is. He's so relatable. I think that's it. There's so many Irish fans who are just sitting in the seats, you know, that you're right, you could go out and you could bump into him and go for a pint. And it feels like you wouldn't just have to talk about rugby. Like, you could talk about anything and, you know, it would be very comfortable conversations. So, and again, like, I don't know him particularly well, but he would never walk past me without nodding the head or saying hello and you know, walking on, and an absolute gentleman. And I think rewind the clock a couple of years, you know, the only noise that was coming out of Irish rugby was that Andy Farrell was a really good lad and the players liked him, and we were all sort of getting on top of them because they hadn't, you know, hit their straps in terms of the rugby ability and the results weren't being shown, and thankfully it's all sort of come to fruition. And you know, the master plan that, you know, him and Mike Cadden and Paul O'Connell and Simon Easterby and, you know, Foggs and all the coaching staff came up with, and then probably a few of the senior players as well, has really, you know, worked so well for us. And hopefully they have another plan up their sleeve for a Rugby World Cup campaign.
See, I don't want to rain on the parade, but we have to point to the obvious thing. When it was 15 against 15, we were only a point in front. We ended up beating 14. Like, when we go to a World Cup, are we going to have to be able to dominate start to finish? Will we get away with playing a first half like we did at Aviva?
Yeah, but Ruby, they always find a way. You know, that's what we got to keep asking ourselves. And I know doubts always creep in, but they haven't played brilliantly for, you know, parts of games over the last 2 years, but they've always found a way to to get it done, and you know, substitutions at the right times, and you know, even taking off Tadhg Furlong with over 20 minutes to go, and young Tom O'Toole coming on to scrummage against Ellis Genge, who's, you know, was captain against France the week before, and an absolute beast of a man. They just seem to find a way. I think with Ross Byrne also, you know, obviously stepping in with when Johnny Sexton's unavailable, there seems to be the ship seems to be a bit steadier, and yeah, it just feels like things are starting to knit together very, very well for us. And yeah, we went down, or England went down to 14 men. Was it a red card? Personally, I didn't think it was a red card. I think because the knock-on had happened, the whistle had gone, I think it was completely accidental. And unfortunately, in rugby, accidental doesn't come into the rule book. If there's contact with the head, then you know, that's the way they got to go with it. But many people have said that it slightly ruined the game for them, more specifically English fans that had paid money. And I think that's the other thing you got to look at. You know, there's millions and millions of people around the world watching that game, broadcasters paying millions as well, the paying fans, you know, the some of the ticket money that I heard people were paying for the weekend just to be in the Aviva Stadium was crazy. And was it the right decision? You know, was that the right decision to send him off? I'm not sure. I think if it was a yellow card given there, then everybody would have, you know, would have went away from the game a lot happier and said that it maybe wasn't spoiled. In my opinion, it wasn't a red card. Did I think Ireland would have lost, or it would have been a tighter game if he had stayed on? Possibly, but I still think they would have won.
Yeah, funny enough, I'm not sure about the red card. I think when he, just the body position he got himself into, I was trying to wonder, how on a rugby pitch do you get yourself into the position Matty Stewart was in? He was standing side on, yeah, using his hip to tackle the player.
But it's a player welfare issue though, isn't it? Like,
I don't know.
Yeah, I think because of the whistle that already went, it was like, you know, I think if the ball still had been live, that he probably would have made a legitimate tackle. Like, but because I think it was just him switching off, and he was just like turned himself, like there was no attempt to make a tackle because he didn't need to make a tackle because there was already a knock on. So like, I sort of feel a little bit sorry for him that way.
Perfect. Anyway, moving back to reality then, competition for places. Can anyone play in their way into that squad? Is there any position in that team you think someone will have an eye on a position?
It looks a bit of a closed door at the minute. The lads are playing serious rugby. I think I'd love to see Finlay Beelam get back to full fitness and with his knee injury, and hopefully he can do that before a Rugby World Cup. We'll wait and see. Ian Henderson, unfortunately, is, you know, a really bad broken arm, and he's going to be missing for Ulster probably for the rest of the season. So Ryan Baird had a pretty good game, somebody who has been waiting in the wings, playing a lot in the back row as well for Leinster. So, you know, he's somebody that maybe put his hand up in it, you know, as a big game player at the weekend, and you know, he might be get a bit more game time over the next couple of months than you know, he maybe thought he would have. So, and that's about it. I think, Ruby, you look at, you know, people are maybe saying that Jacob Stockdale, we all know he has the ability, but he hasn't been playing well enough for Ulster. He was included in the Six Nations squad, but hasn't even had a sniff or been close to getting a sniff. And yeah, the back row is very settled. I think those four lads, you know, Peter O'Mahony and Jack Conan, Josh Van der Fair, Keelan Doris, you can swap around a little bit throughout a tournament, and they will always, you know, deliver for you. And yeah, the units everywhere else. So maybe that 12 position is still up for grabs, you know, with Big Stuart McCluskey and Robbie Henshaw, Bundiaki, who is the best 12 to partner up with Gary Ringrose. We're not on, I think the weekend showed that maybe Robbie Henshaw needs a lot more game time at 13 to you know, be able to deliver at a higher consistent level. So yeah, not too many spots, which I think's a good thing as well.
A bit of love, I think it is too. I think it's a bloody great thing, Stephen. Thanks so much for taking our call. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back with Association Football.
Game on. Boxing.
Now, before we turn our attention to Association Football with former Ireland international David Connolly, just time to hear from Katie Taylor, who was on media duty in Dublin today ahead of our much anticipated homecoming fight against Chantelle Cameron. And Katie Taylor caught up with our own Claire McNamara.
Game on. Boxing.
Like, this is amazing. Pro boxing is coming home. Big time pro boxing is coming home for the first time in a long time. It's amazing that my homecoming fight is happening after 22 fights as a professional boxer. This is incredible, and it's not happening just with any normal fight. This is happening with one of the best fights in boxing right now. Two undisputed champions going head to head together, it has the makings of another fight of the year contender.
Now, we had so much part of this story and part of this build up. Croke Park. How are you feeling about that and the disappointment that it's certainly, for the moment, not happening?
Yeah, I mean, I never really concern myself with those kind of details. My job is just to focus on the boxing part, and that's why I have a team of people around me. Their job is to focus on those details. I obviously would have absolutely loved to fight in Croke Park, our most iconic arena, but I'm just happy that big-time boxing is coming back, and we are people who love this noble art, and for a very small country, we're very, very good at it. And so this is a night to celebrate, and I'm just so excited. I'm so motivated for this fight as well, and I have a chance to become a two-weight undisputed champion. This is huge.
Is this fight a risk to take on?
It's definitely a risky fight. I could have taken an easier route, a mandatory challenger, but that's not what I'm about. One thing that has marked my career, I think, is I've always wanted the hardest fights and the toughest fights out there, and this is a fight that really excites me and motivates me, and like I said, I have a chance to make history. I made it 20. We wanted to bring a fight home to the fans that was deserving of this weight and was worthy of this weight, and two undisputed champions going head to head, this is huge.
Now, you going up a weight, just talk us through that, how difficult, what kind of a challenge that is for you.
I mean, I don't see it as much of a problem. I have won a world title at this weight category before, so it's not an issue for me really. If anything, it's probably a bit easier for me psychologically, because I don't have to worry about making weight. I can just focus on the boxing part and not worry about weight management. But it's obviously a huge fight, a very risky fight, but these are the kind of fights that I want.
Talk to us about your opponent. She's obviously coming into this in good form as well. I know she's coming into the Lion's Den, but it's a huge opportunity for her.
Yeah, this is huge. Obviously, when I heard Serrano was out, I was thinking who the best opponent out there is for the fans, and Chantel was obviously an obvious choice. She has a spotless career, an undisputed champion. She has a big fan base, and she has a style to make this an epic. So she's obviously as motivated as ever as well. I know that every single time I step into the ring, I'm going to see the very best of my opponents, and I have to raise my game along with them as well. So I'm just excited about this fight, and I know that's going to be a tough fight. I expect a tough fight, but I also expect to come home as a two-weight undisputed champion.
Talk to me about how you made this happen, because you very much did. You called out on social media, you called out Eddie Hearn, you called out your Cameron. Was that just out of a sense of frustration?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not one for using my social media much, but when I do use, I guess it makes a big impact. Once we heard that Serrano was out, I was eager to get another big fight signed and sealed, I guess. And I just put that tweet out, and here we are. We're talking about this huge fight now, and it's amazing. I'm just excited about this fight, and I can't wait.
Was there a sense as well, you know, time is ticking on, that time is running out, you just wanted to get this done?
Yeah, exactly. May the 20th was available for the Tree Arena, and why not get a big fight sorted? We don't have to wait until later on in the year to see if Serrano's going to take the fight. We have to get these big fights now, and like I said, this is a fight that really motivates me, and I'm stepping up a way here. I have a chance to win her belts, and this is huge. This is history making.
Just tell me, have you thought ahead about how it will feel to walk out so long awaited in front of a home crowd? It's obviously going to be incredible atmosphere, incredible support for you. Have you dreamed about that moment?
Yeah, I'm nearly pinched myself here, the fact I actually am speaking about it. 22 fights in, and I'm making my homecoming fight. This is a huge moment for just myself, my family, and I'm getting nearly like emotional even thinking about it really, but this is huge for me, and
emotional even thinking about walking out there. Can you let yourself imagine and think about the end of it all and winning at home?
Yeah, I obviously have to just stay focused and stay locked in. I don't want to show too much emotion. I don't want to show my soft side too much. But yeah, I have to just stay focused on the actual fight. But I'm so proud to be representing my country every single time I step into the ring. And the whole country, I think, has supported me through the highs and the lows. And I'm so proud to be able to bring big time boxing back. And this is going to be huge. The atmosphere is going to be electric, and this is going to be the biggest night in my career.
Have you completely given up on the Croke Park dream? Is that still on the table?
I definitely haven't given up, and I would absolutely love to fight in Croke Park, our most iconic arena. But for now, my focus is completely on Chantal Cameron in the Tree Arena. Hopefully, if Croke Park will happen at some stage, but that's for my team to handle. I guess I have to just focus on the boxing part.
Game on, boxing.
Shane, I doubt very much Katie Taylor has listened to the two of us, but showing a bit of emotion is definitely not showing her soft side. There is no soft side to Katie Taylor. No. Emotion, I can understand that, though, after winning an Olympic gold in London and what happened in Rio and having to go abroad to chase her career. It's magic that she's coming back, and it's even better that it feels and means so much to her.
Yeah, and it's great to hear that. There's in any walk of life, I don't think showing emotion is a soft side or a weakness or anything of the sort like that. It's great to just feel that honesty and that rawness as well, that perhaps we don't always see with elite athletes, not just Katie Taylor, but just to feel that. And yeah, no, I can't wait. You're a well-connected man, Ruby. I'll be hitting you up for tickets. That's the more important thing. Never mind that, Nels.
Yeah, I watched the Six Nations. I watched the Grand Slam from the comfort of my couch, Shane Dawson.
That's fair enough. That's fair. Well, sure, look, I'll still be hitting you up for tickets, don't worry, Ruby. You're more connected than I am. More connected than I am. However, let us chat about my favourite subject, Ruby. What's that one called?
Something football. Association football. I'd nearly forgotten. Let's ask David Conley. Does he call it association football?
David Conley?
No, I definitely don't call it that. That's for sure.
That's probably right in me box now.
Well done, David. You're my new hero.
Well, hey, I don't know what's better, though, because, you know, Ireland football, I'm not a big fan of that either, you know. But, hey, the new jersey looks good.
So you having the new jersey?
Yeah, I mean, look, but, you know, big news about the Shamrock and all that, you know. But, yeah, I mean, I like the little bits of detail. I like it on the socks, you know. Mm. Yeah, I think it's a step in the right direction for sure, yeah.
Well, we're fairly convinced it'll look well in Evan Ferguson. What do you think?
Yeah, this guy. I mean, I'm not late to the party on this, but every time I think for months, whenever I've come on to any Irish station, because I've had the benefit of watching him live quite a few times, you know. So I saw him live against West Ham. He didn't score, but his actual technique, his touch, and everything was just incredible. He'd come on an awful lot, you know, since the time I'd saw him before. I mean, you know, kind of, and a lot of that is down to him, but it's also down to how they play, you know. And those that haven't seen Brighton play, that I think they've got the next super coach in Roberto De Zerbi. I think we are blessed because he's going to have the education of a lifetime if that guy is his manager, because they are doing things no one else is doing in the Premier League. It's so nuanced and subtle, but it's such a high level. You've got to see it live, you know. And I know a couple of lads in the team that I played with, you know, Adam Lallana at Brighton, Adam Webster at Portsmouth, you know, they all tell me, and I can see it with my own eyes, this guy is, the coach is next level. And I think Evan Ferguson is going to be, you know, like it. His goal the other day was like Berbatov at his best. Mm. I mean, it was brilliant. It doesn't matter who it's against, you know. So I think the future is so, so bright.
How much are we going to see him develop over the course of the season in terms of, you're speaking of De Zerbi, and there was a quote that he said, with my staff, we are working to improve him to not only become a number nine, but to understand the play, to receive the ball and to attack the space, you know, the complete player.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And you know what, because look, how they play, I won't bore you, you know, because some, you know, but often Ferguson would drop in beside McAllister as like, you know, a number 10. You know, but he can also go the other way. But his touch has come on. His touch reminded me of Niall Quinn. It was so tight and left and right, kept him so close to his body. And, you know, this is against West Ham I'm talking about, you know, and obviously his goal against Grimsby. But he had really come on in the game against West Ham. That comes from playing in such tight areas. I mean, you know, often Brighton have six lads in about a 20 by 10 rectangle trying to play through like they did against Liverpool in the tightest of areas, and they do it. So this is a team that is operating at the highest level. That means Evan Ferguson is operating at the highest level and will only get better. So, wow, I think the world is his oyster, which is great news. But he only got two against Grimsby. When I was 18, 19, I got three. So he's got a bit of a way to go.
He's no David Condy. I've seen that plastered all over social media.
Thank God he's not. That's good.
you talk about the style of play of Brighton. How will that translate for Evan with how Ireland and how Stephen Kenny play?
Well, I mean, that's a good question, but I think what we'll end up on with Ireland is we'll have someone. Evan will be a bit like a Berbatov or a Harry Kane,
or a David Condy.
No, much better than that. So he can do a bit of everything. He'll be so accomplished, you know, he can come to feet if needs be and play with his back to goal. But obviously he can go the other way and be look, he's more physical than a Berbatov. I'm just likening that goal against Grimsby when he took it out the sky with his left foot beautifully. You know, like he'll be able to do a bit of everything. You know, he'll be. I mean, you know, once he's going to start, he's got to start against Latvia. Once he starts, I mean, you know, he'll be the first name on the team sheet. I mean, the whole team should be built around him without a question. Because De Zerbi probably won't say it, right? But with him in their team, they can kind of build their team around him as well. He's probably not saying that, but I mean, his physicality, his size, his finishing from wide areas. You know, he can do it all. So, I mean, Jesus, it's great.
No, that was against Grimsby. They qualify for the semi-final of the FA Cup. They're going to face Manchester United in the semi-final. Sorry, Grimsby in the quarter-final. United beat Fulham 3-1. Workmanlike, I suppose. And I have to think the penalty was a tad lucky, I thought.
Yeah, I mean, this was always, I think, like a bit of a, you know, potential banana skin, as we saw. It had a little bit of luck with the pen, yeah, no doubt. But Fulham are a good team, you know. Fulham are a really, really well-organised team. So I think Ten Hag won't, I don't think he'll be that fussed. Like, he got the job done in the end and they move on, you know. You know, they certainly run them close, Fulham. And look, you can't have players doing what Mitrovic did, you know. I think there is a line, and I think he crossed it. You know, look, it's elite level sport, right? You know, but there's no doubt. I think he just overstepped the mark a bit there.
Very much so, and it'll be interesting to see what fallout there is over that, because yeah, it was disgraceful. We're motoring through the footballing headlines here, David, at good pace. So my next question to you is a nice simple one. Will Antonio Conte be in charge of Tottenham for the next fixture on the 3rd of April at Everton?
Well, I was looking at this, right? When did Jose Mourinho get sacked? About 6 days before the cup final, the league cup final. You know, and I think he'd done that to get a reaction and, you know, maybe things would change, because I think the morale was low. Now, you might argue, well, what's different this time around? I mean, this almost feels a little bit similar. But, you know, maybe there's no cup final. Maybe the Champions League is their cup final that they got to think about. And I tell you what, it wouldn't surprise me if he did. However, I think Levy might think, well, last time I got rid of Mourinho, we lost the cup final, things didn't go particularly well. I think you might keep Antonio until the summer. But I got a feeling that Newcastle are going to overtake him anyway, no matter what. So I think he'll stay, but I'm not too sure they're going to get top four.
David, is the expectation in Tottenham not just too big at times? I mean, when did the last win anything?
Well, yeah, but I mean, goodness. Okay, I look, everyone says that. I understand that sentiment, and it's true. But I don't know. Unless they start spending £500 million or £1 billion, I can't see them closing that gap anytime soon. They probably didn't when Poch was there, right? They probably missed the boat that time, and then now it looks like Harry Kane will go this summer or next summer. And my only thing is, let's hope they might be looking for Evan Ferguson. You never know. I mean, he'd be the sort of ideal replacement. But I mean, I don't know, unless they spend £500 million, which they're not going to, I can't see things changing for Tottenham anytime soon, unless they get an absolute elite level coach like a Pochettino or a De Zerbi to help them bridge that gap. If you don't spend the money, you know, you get there via an elite level coach who can make the difference. And look, Antonio is elite, don't get me wrong, but I don't know, personality wise, obviously it looks like it's not quite working out there.
But final question to you, David, just would you want to play for him as a player? Like, you were a professional footballer, just coming out and saying that.
He
basically gave the lads it's Tottenham speech, but this time it came from the Tottenham manager.
Yeah. Look, I think he's probably said something in public there that he's already said to them in private. So, and a lot of those players will have a thick enough skin, and they should have, to know that and he's quite, you can't say stereotypical, but, you know, he has been volatile before and spoken his mind. And, you know, I don't think necessarily he's going to lose the players over that. And I think players would rather have someone who is a bit honest, than someone who sugarcoats stuff. I don't think the players are, the players will know that they should have won that game. You know, they should have known. Southampton injuries to the two centre-halves, 3-1 up. Of course they blew it away. If you had a manager come out and said, oh, don't worry, things will be okay, you know, you'd be there going, what is this guy on about? So, a lot of frustration at Tottenham at a minute. But look, they know he's not going to be there because his contract's running out. So they've probably got their eyes on thinking, who's coming next?
Well, the truth can often hurt. David Connolly, thanks for taking our call. We will have Alan Colley in studio tomorrow evening to get to the rest of the soccer, including Arsenal, Man City and Chelsea. We have another quick break to take.
Game on. Gaelic football.
Now, you're very welcome back to the final part of Game On with myself, Shane Dawson, and Ruby Walsh, as Peter Canavan and Neil Ewing join us now to chat Gaelic football, because the National Football League stock has risen dramatically over the last decade, and the latest addition has only added to its reputation as a sizeable number of teams head into the final day of action with something to play for. Now, there is only one absolute certainty heading into the final round of Division 1 games, and that's Mayo's presence in the league final after Kevin McSay's revigorated outfit collected 10 points from a possible 12. So, Peter Canavan, my question is simple. Mayo for Sam?
Mayo for Sam. I think we say that every year, do we not, at this time of the year?
No, but on a more serious note, how inspired will Mayo fans be with their performance over the league? I mean, if you put all 32 counties together, only Derry and Cavan have improved or have impressed more in terms of points on the board.
Look, absolutely, and it's not just that they're sitting top of the table, it's not that they've qualified for the National League. I think it's the manner of their performances that will really hearten the Mayo supporters. They're playing football with a bit of style, with a serious amount of confidence, and they now have a wee bit of punch up front, which maybe they didn't have in previous years. It seems very clear that he's playing Nathan O'Shea at the edge of the square, so they have a real strong target man. But just look at the quality of the players around him. And with Tommy Conroy coming back, he's beginning to get really sharp once again. So you throw him and Ryan O'Donoghue running either side of Aidan O'Shea there, and it's going to be hard for any defence to stop. And their ball carrying, even despite the absence of Lee and Oisin Mullen, their defence appears to be really strong, the big men around the middle. So look, absolutely, there's renewed optimism in Mayo like never before. But as I say, it is early days. There's a lot of football to be played, especially the nature of the championship this year with the round robin and the four groups of four. So look, it's early days. That's all I'm saying. It's early days.
Neil, Shane is joking about Mayo for Sam, but I don't think anybody would be joking when say Donegal not for Sam. They look to be in complete disarray, and to me it looked like they flattered Mayo yesterday afternoon.
Yeah, Ruby, the defeat was one thing for Donegal yesterday, but it was probably the manner of the defeat. Such a proud record in Ballyboffey. Mayo, with such a poor record in Donegal, you know, had never won a league game in Donegal before, and they just seemed that little bit lifeless. And, you know, I think a lot has been spoken about Donegal, you know, probably over the winter, over the last few weeks, maybe slow on appointing manager, you know, Michael Murphy stepping away, then you had the injury to Paddy McBrearty. But, you know, Oisin Gallen came on yesterday. He also went off. You know, it just seems like blow after blow. And, you know, I think even understated the absence of, you know, losing someone like Neil McGee, who was probably maybe not a definite starter for the last year or two, but, you know, a real experienced header on the pound. You know, when things are starting to go against you like this, that's when you really start to miss just a wise old head like that, a pragmatic head. You know, to just circle the wagons. I think, you know, Donegal may even have been better playing away from home yesterday, just with everything going on off the pitch in Donegal and that negativity. When they went a few points down, the energy drained out of the crowd and that kind of reflected onto the players themselves, I felt a little yesterday.
Peter, Donegal have struggled completely to improve through the league, but that can't be said of Tyrone, and they have made steady progress under Brian Duher. A lot of improvement in their attack and even in their defence, the spirit of their play. You must be fairly happy with them.
Yeah, compared to this time a few weeks ago, Ruby, we were in a completely different place. And you talk about, you know, leadership, and you're comparing Throne and Donegal when the gun was put to the heads of the Throne players. And it was put to them by us and many in media. But I've no doubt Brian and Fergal asked serious questions of them. And they've got a response. Now, I wouldn't say that we're championship winning material or close to, you know, the way Mayo's playing at the minute, but at least we're heading in the right direction and there will be further improvement. And you compare that, as you say, with Donegal, and the two games that stand out for me were the game against Throne and the game yesterday, where when things started to get tight, when they started to go behind, you know, Donegal of a previous era, their leaders really stood up. Whereas, yeah, I'd say that was most disappointing for Paddy Carr yesterday, is once the goal went in, you could see the Donegal heads going down, and it was only heading one way. So look, yeah, they're going to have to regroup. They're going down to Division 2 next year. But look, they have the Ulster Championship to look forward to, and they have time. There's new management in, so we've got to give them a wee bit of time.
A very competitive Ulster Championship, no doubt, because the four bottom teams in Division 1 are all Ulster teams who will have certainly a point to prove come Championship time. But Neil, one team that, I suppose, are you surprised to see them where they are, Galway? I know the league final isn't decided yet. We know that Mayo are there, but Galway are best placed to join them and ensure a Connacht derby. Are you surprised or expected to see them up there?
Yeah, I suppose, you know, they started the league with a draw against Mayo, and, you know, there's probably a few questions asked of them. You know, really, I think what Pádraig Joyce and Keane O'Neill would have wanted from this league would have been to develop a little bit more depth in their panel. You know, we've seen it in All-Ireland final last year. Maybe when they turned to the bench, they just didn't have the game changers that Kerry had. They started the league down a few heads, and then they probably had a few injuries on top of that. So they really probably had the ideal league for themselves today, in that they've developed a bit of depth that they intended to, and they've also had to develop another layer of depth below that. So, you know, I think Pádraig Joyce would be absolutely delighted. You know, especially, you know, you look at that performance in Armagh on Saturday evening, and just the manner of it, how they dug it out. You know, it was just a horrible evening, horrible conditions, a tough place to go to. You know, if ever there's fans that get behind your team for a Saturday night game, it's, you know, that Armagh faithful at the minute. And you know, they were just really dogged in the second half there, held the ball when they had the, you know, I think that's even a big hallmark of the improvement goal we've made in the past 12 to 18 months. It's just the different styles of play that they can use now. Obviously, everyone knows they have lovely, stylish footballers, always have, you know, it's so cliched. But, you know, Pádraig Joyce has also kind of adopted a little bit of realism into his ideal, along with his idealism. And, you know, they're well able to hold on to the ball, be defensive, shut up shop when they need to. And, you know, there's maybe even a lot that the likes of a Meade could learn from that, where, you know, Colm O'Rourke has went in, he's been very vocal about wanting to kick the ball, play attacking football. And, you know, it probably hasn't went according to plan for them. He could probably learn a lot from how Pádraig Joyce has tweaked the goal we set up in the last few months.
You can tell Colm O'Rourke he should watch Pádraig Joyce. Neil, if you don't mind. I don't think anyone will get involved in that conversation anyway. But Peter, Kerry are the time on the run to perfection. That's going to be the big game next weekend. Kerry v Galway, to see who can take on Mayo. Roscommon, their run has slightly come to an end, has it?
Yeah, I think so. It was a big ask for Roscommon to stay up in this division to begin with, Ruby. So look, they'll be more than happy. I think they will. 6 points will see them safe the way the final games are going to pan out. But you're right, the big game, Galway and Kerry. I would love to see Galway and Mayo compete. in the National League final, I think that would be a clinker. Last year, Kerry and Mayo played, and I'm not too sure how concerned Mayo were about competing against Kerry, but the fact that it would be Galway, it would certainly whet their appetite. So that's a massive one. But look, there's some great games in every division in the final league Sunday. You know, games that are going to either get teams promoted or get them relegated. So there's a lot of stake. And before you go, I know we're running out of time because you spent most of the evening talking about association football, Ruby. But I want to give a special mention to Louth and the progress that they have made, because the fact that at the start of the year most people would have thought they'd do well to stay in Division 2, they're now competing with Dublin to decide who will actually go up, and I've no doubt they'll give them a real game next Sunday. So
there's no county loyalties in that shout out for Louth, is there?
Not at all. Would you not agree with me?
I would agree with you completely, but you're surely going to give the manager a shout out as well, like.
Absolutely, sure. It takes some doing to take a team from Division 4 right up to the verge of getting into Division 1. So,
I think Gavin Devlin, as coach along with Mickey, really, he deserves a call out too. For another Tyrone man, unfortunately.
Absolutely, the both of them, Shane, absolutely. And it's some achievement. Now, they're not there yet, but I've no doubt Mickey will have his sights firmly set in Dublin this weekend.
Well, as a Kildare man, I will be hoping Louth can do that. There is no doubt about that. Gents, thanks a million for taking our call. Trying to fit in hurling this evening, but Niall Moran will join us tomorrow along with Áine O'Gorman on soccer and Alan Colley, Mark Langdon as usual. And we have a €400 giveaway thanks to PwC. I hope you enjoyed this evening. Bette de Silva's up next. Shane, chat to you tomorrow.
Schlan. RTE 2FM.